Hi, and welcome to the Great South African Tales podcast. I'm Dave Charles, and here is another great tale from the pen of Herman Charles Bosman. Peaches Ripening in the Sun is set in the time of the Second Boer War, when Wormskull Lodens and his companions have joined a commando that rides off to do battle with the British. Wormskull rides with Ben Meiber, who's young and optimistic and believes that after the war, he'll go back to his lovely young wife and his flourishing peach orchard. Sadly, this is not to be.
Peaches Ripening in the Sun. The way Ben Meiber lost his memory, Wormskull Lodens said, made a deep impression on all of us. We reasoned that it was the sort of thing that a sudden shock could do to you. There were those in our small section of General de Toy's commando who could recall similar stories of how people in a moment could forget everything about the past just because of a single dreadful happening. A shock like that can have the same effect on you even if you are prepared for it. Maybe it can be worse even. And in this connection, I often think of what it says in the good book about that which you most fear having now at last caught up with you. Our commando went as far as the border by train, and when the engine came to a stop on a piece of open veld, and if it wasn't for water this time, and the engine driver and the fireman didn't step down with a spanner and use bad language, then we understood that the train stopping there was the beginning of the Second Boer War. We were wearing new clothes, and we had new equipment, and the sun was shining on the barrels of our Mosers. Our new clothes had been requisitioned for us by our Feldkornet at stores along the way. All the Feldkornet had to do was to sign his name on a piece of paper for whatever his men purchased. In most cases, after we had patronized a store in that manner, the shopkeeper would put up his shutters for the day. And 3 years would pass, and the Boer War would be over before the shopkeeper would display any sort of inclination to take the shutters down again. Maybe he should have put them up before we came. Only one sexy of General de Toy's commando entered Natal looking considerably dilapidated. This sexy looked as though it was already the end of the Boer War and not just the beginning. Afterwards, we found out that their Feldkornet had never learned to write his name. We were glad that in that first big battle, these men kept well to the rear, apparently conscious of how sinful they looked. For to make matters worse, a regiment of Indian troops was fighting on that front, and we were not anxious that an Eastern race should see white men at such a disadvantage. "You don't seem to remember me, Skulk," a young fellow came up and said to me. I admitted that I didn't recognize him straight away as Ben Meiber. He did look different in those smart, light green riding pants and that new hat with the ostrich feather stuck in it. You could see that he'd patronized some mine concession store before the owner got his shutters down. "But I would know you anywhere, Skulk," Ben Meiber went on, "just from the quick way you hid that soap under your saddle a couple of minutes ago. I remember where I'd last seen something so quick. It was 2 years ago at the Nachmal in Nailstrom. I told Ben Meiber that if it was that jar of brandy he meant, then he must realize that there had also been a good deal of misunderstanding about it. Moreover, it was not even a full jar, I said. But I congratulated him on his powers of memory, which I said I was sure would yet stand the Republic in good stead. And I was right. For afterwards, when the war of the big commandos was over, and we were in constant retreat, it would be Ben Meiber who, next day, would lead us back to the donga in which we'd hidden some millimeal and a tin of cooking fat. And if the tin of cooking fat was empty, he would be able to tell us right away if it was passers-by or baboons. A passer-by had a different way of eating cooking fat out of a tin from what a baboon had, Ben Meiber said. Ben Meiber had been recently married to Mimi van Blerk, who came from Schweizerenica, a district that was known as far as the Limpopo for its attractive girls. I remembered Mimi van Blerk well. She had full red lips and thick yellow hair. Ben Meiberg always looked forward very eagerly to getting letters from his pretty young wife. He would also read out to us extracts from her letters in which he encouraged us to drive the English into the blue grass, which was the name we gave to the sea in those days. For the English, we had other names. One of Mimi's letters was accompanied by a wooden candle box filled with dried peaches. Ben Meiberg was most proud to share out the dried fruit among our company, for he had several times spoken of the orchard of yellow-clinked peaches that he had laid out at the side of his house.
"We've already got dried peaches," Yuri Becker said.
Then he added, making free with our projected invasion of Natal, "In a few weeks' time, we'll be picking bananas." It was in the spirit, as I have said, that we set out to meet the enemy. But nobody knew better than ourselves how much of this fine talk was to hide what we really felt. And I know, speaking for myself, that when we got the command, "Opsal!" and we were crossing the border between the Transvaal and Natal, I was less happy at the thought of my horse, which was such a mettlesome animal. For it seemed to me that my horse was far more anxious to invade Natal than I was. I had to rein him in a good deal on the way to Spionkop and Colenso, and I told myself that it was because I did not want him to go too fast downhill. 18 months later saw the armed forces of the Republic in a worse case than I should imagine any army has ever been in, and that army is still fighting. We were spread all over the country in small groups. We were in rags. Many burghers had been taken prisoner. Others had yielded themselves to the British magistrates, holding not their rifles in their hands but their hats. There were a number of Boers also who had gone and joined the English. For the Transvaal Republic, it was near the end of a tale that you tell sitting around a kitchen fire on a cold night. The story of the Transvaal Republic was at that place where you clear your throat before saying which of the two men the girl finally married, or whether it was the cattle smuggler or the Sunday school superintendent who stole the money, or whether it was a real ghost or just her uncle with a sheet round him that Letty van Sale saw at the drift. One night, when we were camped outside Nietverdient, and it was Ben Meiberg and my turn to go on guard, he told me that he knew that part well. "You see that runt there, Skulk," he said. "Well, I've often stood on the other side of it under the stars, just like now. You know I've got a lot of peach trees on my farm. Well, I've stood there under the ripening peaches just after dark with Mimi at my side. There's no smell like the smell of young peach trees in the evening, Skulk, when the fruit is ripening. I can almost imagine I'm back there now, and it's just time for it, too." I tried to explain to Ben Meiberg in a roundabout way that although everything might be exactly the same on this side of the runt, he would have to be prepared for certain changes on the other side, seeing that it was war. Ben Meiberg agreed that I was probably right. Nevertheless, he began to talk to me at length about his courtship days. He spoke of Mimi with her full red lips and her yellow hair. "I can still remember the evening when Mimi promised that she would marry me, Skulk," Ben Meiberg said. "It was in Zierist. We were there for the Nachmal. When I walked back to my tent on the Kark Plain, I was so happy that I just kicked the first three passers-by I saw." I could see that talking to me while he stood on guard, Ben Meiberg was living through that time all over again. I was glad for their sakes that no passers-by came past at that moment, for Ben Meiberg was again very happy. I was pleased too, for Ben Meiberg's own sake, that he did at least have that hour of deep joy in which he could recall the past so vividly. For it was after that his memory went. By the following evening, we'd crossed the runt and had arrived at Ben Meiberg's farm. We camped among the smoke-blackened walls of his former homestead, erecting a rough shelter with some sheets of corrugated iron that we could still use. And although he must have known only too well what to expect, yet what Ben Meiberg saw there came as so much of a shock to his senses that from that moment, all he could remember from the past vanished forever. It was pitiful to see the change that had come over him. If his farm had been laid to ruins, the devastation that had taken place in Ben Maybach's mind was no less dreadful. Perhaps it was that, in truth, there was nothing more left in the past to remember. We noticed also that in singular ways, certain fragments of the bygone would come into Ben Maybach's mind, and that he would almost, but not quite, succeed in fitting these pieces together. We observed that almost immediately. For instance, we remained camped on his farm for several days. And one morning when the fire for our millipap was crackling under one of the few remaining fruit trees that had once been an orchard, Ben Maybach reached up and picked a peach that was in advance of its season, ripe and yellow. "It's funny," Ben Maybach said, "but I seem to remember from long ago reaching up and picking a yellow peach just like this one. I don't quite remember where." We did not tell him that he was picking one of his own peaches. Some time later, our sexy was captured in a night attack. For us, the Boer War was over. We were going to St. Helena. We were being driven to Nielstroom, the nearest railhead, in a mule wagon. It was a strange experience for us to be driving along the main road in broad daylight for all the world to see us. From years of wartime habit, our eyes still went to the horizon. A bitter thing about our captivity was that among our guards were men of our own people. Outside Nielstroom, we alighted from the mule wagon, and the English sergeant in charge of our escort got us to form fours by the roadside. It was queer, our having to learn to be soldiers at the end of a war instead of at the beginning. Eventually, we got into some sort of formation, the Feldkornet, Yuri Becker, Ben Maybach, and I making up the first four. It was already evening. From a distance, we could see the lights in the town. The way to the main street of Nielstroom led by the cemetery. Although it was dark, we could yet distinguish several rows of newly made mounds. We did not need to be told that they were concentration camp graves. We took off our battered hats and tramped on in great silence. Soon we were in the main street. We saw then what those lights were. There was a dance at the hotel. Paraffin lamps were hanging under the hotel's low, wide veranda. There was much laughter. We saw girls and English officers. In our unaccustomed fours, we slouched past in the dark. Several of the girls went inside then, but a few of the women folk remained on the veranda, not looking in our direction. Among them I noticed particularly a girl leaning on an English officer's shoulder. She looked very pretty, with the light from a paraffin lamp shining on her full lips and yellow hair. When we had turned the corner and the darkness was wrapping us round again, I heard Ben Maybach speak. "It's funny," I heard Ben Maybach say, "but I seem to remember from long ago a girl with yellow hair just like that one. I don't quite remember where." And this time too, we did not tell him.
Join us in the next episode of this podcast series for another gem of a story from the Mafeking Road collection.